Hey everyone, this is Aging Otakus, the podcast where we review anime from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. I'm Jorge, and this is Eric.
Hey there.
And welcome to our first episode.
Yeah, so with this first episode, we'll be going over the classic anime Ronin Warriors. The purpose of this show is basically to give a broad overview of the first episode, or an OVA, of both mainstream and more obscure anime. Just kind of giving a commentary and maybe analyzing the cultural impact that the show has had as a whole.
Yeah, we're going to be doing a dive into things that maybe aren't as popular nowadays or didn't really catch on in the West. They may have caught on more in Japan or vice versa. Maybe it's a show that was huge here and didn't really catch on in Japan, but you know, the anime landscape has changed so much over the years that it's kind of interesting to take a look back.
Oh, definitely. I think especially considering that the more so the 90s is sort of the kind of the swan song of sort of cell animation. You know, it's right in that transitional period from being completely hand done to completely digital and starting in like the mid 2000s. So I think it sort of kind of captures the best of Japanese animation, kind of the culmination of all, you know, the things that they've done since the 60s before they make that such a drastic change.
And it was also such an explosive time for anime and anime fandom in the United States, which is, you know, where both of us are based here. So it's just an interesting era all around for observing the medium, really.
Yeah, truly. I mean, I think about it all the time that the early and mid 90s in the US is very much like a wild west of what was allowed on TV, simply because, you know, it was a very niche kind of product coming to the US, so there weren't a lot of eyes on it. And I think also with it being the 90s, it sort of kind of drew attraction from the more extreme sorts of anime to kind of like speak to that American customer. Yeah, it's just a wild time what they would allow prior to the, you know, the mass acceptance of anime in the US.
Yeah, and it was still a niche thing for sure, but interestingly enough, like it in retrospect, it does feel like anime was all over the place, just in tiny amounts. I mean, it was on the Sci-Fi Channel, Cartoon Network, syndication, video rental store. There'd be a little anime section.
Yeah, I mean that's a good point. Yeah, there you're right. There definitely was anime sort of spread out everywhere. It's just I think until, you know, the late '90s when Toonami started, you know, there wasn't just a sort of a central place to get it all from, and you knew you would be able to find anime there. It was just, you know, places like Suncoast or Blockbuster Video when you would find this, you know, the tiny little anime section with Ghost in the Shell and, you know, Akira there.
And, you know, it was kind of fun growing up in that time and seeing that anime section in Suncoast kind of like grow and become bigger and move over to DVDs and move over to like merchandise and all of that and kind of like grow along with the fandom itself. You know, like one thing like that I'd like to definitely talk about is like how each of us got into anime ourselves in this time.
Oh yeah, that sounds good.
For me, I definitely caught on that a lot of these early morning cartoons, getting ready for school, would be a little different, a little more, you know, they shared that art style and they're a little more exciting, a little more colorful and dynamic. And eventually just kind of made that connection that like, oh, there's this whole subculture, there's this whole animation style, and gradually just getting more and more into it and getting sucked into that wormhole a fair bit. And then, yeah, Toonami came around, had a really solid block of cool action anime and all that. And, you know, just the rest is history right there.
So do you have like a favorite, like what was your favorite anime as a kid?
Oh, I was definitely a Dragon Ball Z kid for
yeah
for so long. I mean, that's which I imagine is many many people who are in anime in that era. I did watch Robotech and Voltron in reruns at some point. I just didn't really know that that was anime till after the fact. But
right,
yeah, definitely a Dragon Ball Z guy. Although I would wind up becoming more of a Mecha and Super Robot fan over time. So apparently those other two shows kind of planted their seeds early.
Yeah, for sure. It's very eye-catching, like the huge pops of color that anime kind of creates, and the such a distinctive style that when you're a young kid in the 90s where all you've been watching is like Tiny Toons and things like that, like it really does differentiate itself by being so such a stark difference from United US animation. And it kind of like, because you don't know where to get it and it was so hard to find, you know, it sort of kind of feeds into that kind of early fandom creation to make you kind of search these things out and try to find them and kind of keep them to yourself.
Yeah, and it definitely lends to like the allure in that time. I mean, for, you know, some of the younger listeners might not really have gotten to experience this a lot, but like this wasn't an era where you could just hop on the internet, Google something, pull up Wikipedia and be like, oh, Ronin Warriors, also known as blah, blah, blah in Japan, was a series from 1980, you know, like you couldn't really do that. You couldn't really immerse yourself instantly with what was on TV. It was just kind of there and you just kind of watched it and you either liked it or you didn't. But, you know, unless someone else at school was also watching the same show as you were, it was just kind of mysterious almost. I think it added to that mystique.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I mean, when you're a kid, like you're searching for that sort of creation of your own identity, and I think that being an anime fan kind of lends itself to that, because it's like this little secret world that only you know, and it wasn't, you know, so easily found that like it kind of encourages people to kind of keep them to themselves, but at the same time like seek out other people that have this same sort of interest.
Right, and you know, seeing another kid with like, a Dragon Ball Z T-shirt or you know, some kind of like Sailor Moon thing on their backpack hanging off there was such a like instant connection, because this wasn't somewhere where you could just log on social media and join. You know, you couldn't get on Discord. You couldn't connect with other fans that easily. So,
yeah. Totally. Different era. So I mean, oh yeah, it's something that's never going to happen again. Since the internet is a thing now, like you'll never be able to have that kind of experience again. My experience and introduction to anime is very, very similar to yours. I grew up as a kid in Okinawa for a little bit as an Air Force brat. So I had an earlier exposure to Japanese animation, but being that young, I didn't think it was anything special. It's just sort of all I knew. I initially was attracted to Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z. Because that was just like the biggest anime in both Japan and the US when we came back. So I think that my introduction to Dragon Ball on UPN and Sailor Moon also, that was one of the few places that you'd be able to find anime in syndication, at least in Nevada. Other than that, of course, you'd be able to find stuff on like Sci-Fi Channel and Cartoon Network once that started getting bigger. But my initial introduction to anime was also Dragon Ball Z, and I remember I actually remember when they actually made that transition from Dragon Ball to Dragon Ball Z, and I remember like going outside on Saturday morning and like finding my friends and being like, hey, do you know what Dragon Ball Z is? Like it's this new thing and Goku's like grown up. It's really weird. And just kind of that experience, it kind of just sticks with you as like these cultural moments that happened in your life as a child.
Now that's I feel like that's rare. The you know, someone that grew up with the original Dragon Ball. I mean, I that definitely passed me by, and I feel like a lot of people didn't really catch the original Dragon Ball until well after the fact, after it aired, when they started redubbing it.
I was never super into it as much as I was much more a Dragon Ball Z guy. But, you know, I definitely remember as a kid liking Dragon Ball, because it's just so appealing to a kid. You know, it's like you've got Yamcha, who used to be the coolest guy in the world, and, you know, you've got Goku and just running around, and there's Pilaf and Piccolo, and it's like, it's just like an interesting adventure show before it turns into this big, giant, like, sci-fi epic.
Right. It's got, you know, it's kind of a combination of everything that, you know, for young boys, like, in American pop culture in that era, like, it's a combination of superheroes and sci-fi and martial arts and, like, all these things kind of mashed together in one package. And so I think that's why Dragon Ball Z was such a hit here.
Totally. And, I mean, speaking to that, I mean, martial arts in the 90s was just, like, a huge thing. I mean, do you remember that? Like,
It was all over. It was, I mean, you know, Power Rangers, like, a massive juggernaut. So many Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, Jackie Chan movies, all that. I mean, I don't know if you remember that weird WMAC Masters show on, like, Fox Kids.
Bro, I totally remember that show, and it was great.
It was wonderful. Let's bring that back. I mean, come on, like,
It was Mortal Kombat. Like, that's all. But it was, like, Mortal Kombat on ESPN.
It was a wonderful time for, like, weird kid show experimentation and martial arts like that.
Totally.
That was great.
Yeah, I don't know. It was like, I think it was, do you think it was just that bleed over from, like, the late 80s sort of martial arts films, and then it just, like, because it was so popular in film that they just, like, wanted to start putting it on television?
There's got to be some kind of connection to that. I mean, I'm sure, especially back then, it just took so much longer to identify and, like, catch on to a profitable trend like that. And
totally,
they just all went for it a couple of years later.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember WMAC Masters, and I think maybe paid off because it was on for at least a few years. So
I think they got a couple of seasons out of it. I mean, it was kind of that might be an interesting one to explore down the line
I'm
if
down
we branch out.
On it. Yeah, totally.
I mean, it was kind of like it has shades of what, you know, today a lot of people do with pro wrestling, the whole, like, smart mark culture of being in on the behind the scenes, but.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was total, like, kayfabe, but also the backstage analyst kind of look at the WMAC's Masters tournament.
And then there were morals at the end of every story because, you know, you need that.
Yeah, it was the war on drugs. It was a strange time in the 90s.
We learned something about friendship and not smoking crack.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, fighting the AIDS epidemic as well. That was big in the 90s. So, do you want to get into the episode, or is there anything else that you feel like you want to kind of talk about in terms of growing up as a 90s kid?
That should about cover it. It was just a very different time, but there's definitely some trends, some undercurrents. I'm sure, you know, we'd love to hear from anyone else that grew up in that era or that didn't and is just interested. Be sure to follow us on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. We can find us on Twitter at Aging Otakus. There you can find out basically what episodes we'll be doing, as well as, you know, things that I think are funny in terms of the anime meme community. Just give us a follow and, you know, we'll see where we go from there. If you want to maybe submit some requests for future episodes or maybe tell us what your favorite anime was as you were growing up, we'd definitely love to hear it.
Yeah, and if you're Gen Z, if you're a Zoomer, just roast us for being old.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely well acquainted with being a washed-up old weeaboo, so yeah, please let us know. So let's get into the episode. Today we watched the anime series Ronin Warriors, Episode 1, Shadowlands. This episode debuted in 1995, I believe, but the anime itself got its start in 1988 and made a run till 1989.
Right, which is another interesting little, like, artifact of that era. Is so many of, like, the iconic anime that we watched in that time was actually, like, 5, 10, maybe 15 years old by the time it got dubbed.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show why we were so okay with, you know, protagonists having mullets and not finding that strange or anything.
And they still look better than a lot of the stuff we were watching otherwise.
Yeah, it's not like a hockey mullet or anything. It's like a fashion mullet. But I think the ocean Ocean Group did the dubbing for this. Is that correct? Do you know if that's true or not?
Right. It does seem that Ocean Group did at least some work on the voices. They are credited in the end credits.
Okay. Yeah. And so I know that the original studio that produced it in Japan was Sunrise. So I mean, you can kind of see it from the animation style that it does definitely have that Sunrise look about it.
Right, Sunrise, you know, known for probably most famously for Mobile Suit Gundam, but also Cowboy Bebop and a couple of other classics there.
I think Tenchi as well is a Sunrise product.
And they've also done a little bit of work on a couple of American productions, Batman the Animated Series, as just, you know, like in between side work there, and G.I. Joe.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, segueing into that, I think it is odd, like, not being well acquainted with anime in the 90s as a kid, despite the fact that a lot of the mainstay American cartoons that came out, like G.I. Joe, Thundercats, Silverhawks, those are all American productions, but done by Japanese studios.
Right. Yeah, it was an interesting time for that, because I feel like, you know, watching a show like Inspector Gadget, which I think is also a Sunrise co-production on some level, or they did animation work on it at least, kind of tracing those similar character designs and art styles behind it was really really interesting.
Yeah, it was like, it's when you would watch television as a kid, like you wouldn't necessarily know it until you saw it, but it was like kind of peppered in where you could definitely tell that there was something different about these shows compared to, you know, Looney Tunes or whatever. It's just like there's just a little bit more attention to detail. The anatomy of characters is a lot more accurate. It's just, you know, and the quality is just like a bigger jump up in quality than, you know, the American cartoon industry that would just churn things out.
Yeah, this definitely was a big step up from, like, the Hanna-Barbera reruns.
Sure. But I do love Hanna-Barbera, though.
Gotta love them.
We watched the first episode of Ronin Warriors. Now, the intro to this was a very American intro that they kind of did, like, a generic heavy metal opening, which I'm not a fan of.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of similar shows like the Mega Man cartoon from around the same time.
The Super Fighting Robot Mega Man.
Yeah, they think they're making a theme song, but they're really just repeating a phrase over and over, a guitar riff that's kind of half-assed.
That's how you hook the kids, though. You got to do the repetition.
You gotta make those earworms.
Now, I mean, that's how Pokemon works.
Hey. Now, granted, I do think there is something about how every episode could be somebody's first episode, and so I think that's why a lot of these, especially like syndicated shows, have very intense narration in these intros.
Oh yeah, totally.
But yeah, I mean, we were robbed, unfortunately, of a of quite a good Pet Shop Boys-esque banger of a theme song, the original Japanese version, which was wonderful.
Yeah, that song is called, I don't remember what it's called. I think I have it written down.
Stardust Eyes by Mariko Uranishi.
Yeah, that song is a certified blammer. And you're right, we were definitely robbed of it, you know, in lieu of the most basic of introductions from, you know, whatever American production company decided to throw onto us. But yeah, so the episode starts off with a looming shadow over the city of Toyama, I believe it is. I don't think it's Tokyo, which was odd. I always assumed it was Tokyo, but looking over Wikipedia, I guess they're in the city of Toyama, where we find a looming shadow of a giant monster, and we meet a young lady named Mia Koji and her grandfather, who definitely know something is wrong, and it might be the end of the world, according to him, and possibly due to this thing called the Dynasty, which is, you know, the most vaguely Asian evil organization name they could think of, but yeah, it's not good.
Yeah, it's like they go smack dab into just the evil apocalyptic imagery, which for a kid back then looks really badass, you know, all the thunder, the lightning, the dark clouds and all that. That the imagery is definitely really powerful, but yeah.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, I think that's definitely one thing that 90s and 80s anime got right was lightning effects. Like they're definitely in full display here in this episode. It's, you know, it's just so vibrant and like it's such a good look. And I think that Sunrise knows it, and they're just definitely like putting it out in full effect for us. It looks great. You know, once Mia and her grandfather recognize that something is wrong, something appears on the television where it is a young man walking through the streets of Toyama with a giant white tiger named Ryo, who they seem to know who he is.
Yeah, just a boy and his tiger out of nowhere, and we're supposed to take this for granted because Grandpa and Mia do too.
Yeah, and it's nice they threw in a very 90s Siegfried and Roy reference in the dub version, which, you know, us as Las Vegans, I think, can appreciate. And yeah, so Ryo is surrounded here pretty much, and we find a young boy named Uli and his parents out who come across this, and he finds himself face-to-face with White Blaze, Ryo's tiger.
And then we find ourselves with a little bit more of that ominous lightning, and we get an evil samurai hopping out of a neon sign.
Yeah, and this guy is straight up, like, giant half-man, half-mecha-looking armor design, and the production for this and the character designs are very good. He looks very menacing, and he's, like, 30 feet tall.
Yeah, he's definitely very, very beastly, and the direction work for this always shows him as looming and menacing.
Yeah, it kind of gave me the same vibes as, did you remember that movie, Dragon, the Bruce Lee story?
No.
Oh, it's a remake of Bruce Lee's life, but, like, throughout the whole movie, there is just this evil, faceless, like, samurai chasing him down, like, in his dreams. And, this character definitely gave me those kind of vibes.
Yeah, it's definitely, evil, demonic, you know, menacing force. Really cool armor design, which I think we'll see shortly, is a hallmark of this series too.
Yeah. So Ryo sees this guy and challenges the dynasty to a pretty much a one-on-one battle, and we find out that under his clothes he's wearing a plug suit essentially, of his base level Ronin Warrior armor.
Yeah, kind of just like a streamlined sort of like pilot suit sort of thing that he's got going on there.
Yeah, it definitely gave me like it brought me back to like a Pacific Rim kind of look. Like it looks streamlined but also kind of bulky. It's very cool. And like with all Sentai groups or you know, shonen anime, he definitely has like a color palette assigned to just him. So It's a red and white sort of Pacific Rim.
Which, let's not forget, red is the official color of the leader in all of these shows.
Yes, I mean, how else are you going to show off your fiery determination unless you're wearing predominantly red? This nameless minion and Ryo engage in battle, and it's really not going so well. You know, Ryo tries some things, doesn't really work out, and then White Flame tries to get in on it, and the samurai bad guy pretty much just uppercuts the shit out of Ryo's tiger, and he's kind of got Ryo on the ropes.
Yeah, things aren't looking good for him, but
he is saved by a blue samurai or a blue Ronin warrior named Is it Rowan or is it Sai that saves him? I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's saved by Sai, the blue Ronin warrior, who has probably one of the strangest accents for a brief moment in all of 90s dubbed anime. Like, it's all over the place. In just a couple of words, he sounds Australian, Southern, sounds like he's from Maine. Strange.
It's buck wild. And if he had kept that up, because I think he kind of finds his groove later in the episode and hopefully throughout the series, but if he had kept that up, that weird thing that he had created, if he had kept that up through the whole thing, it probably would have been the best anime voice in history.
The man just wanted to show off his talents.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also, I looked up the voice actors for the main boys, and Ryo is done by Matt Hill, who is Kira from Gundam Seed, as well as Ed from Ed, Edd n Eddy.
Huh. A man of range.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, Kira and Ed. That's pretty wide apart. Sai saves him, and it turns out that Ryo is not alone, and there are four other beautiful boys to maybe help him out fighting this bad guy.
And now you know why the show is not called Ronin Warrior, but rather Ronin Warriors.
Yeah, and it's strange. Like, I was always wondering this, because it seems like all the other guys know who they are, who each other are, and Ryo is just the lone guy that kind of just happened to be there.
Yeah, they didn't really establish that clearly. I think we're maybe supposed to just take it for granted, or they figure the audience would just kind of roll with it. But yeah, there's no, at least in the first episode, there's no real explanation, no real mythos. Maybe it's something they get into a little later, but
yeah, as of right now, it's just sort of like, hey, we were just hanging out and we found out that you were here getting, you know, rocked by this giant golem samurai guy. So, you know, Sai shows up and turns out he's brought the rest of the boys with him. And we get probably what I think is the coolest anime introduction to a character in the green Ronin Warrior, Sage, who is currently falling upside down off of a building with his arms crossed like it doesn't even bother him.
Every team has a pretty boy. Every team has a cool guy. And he's both, in a way, I think.
I mean, they all kind of are, save for the brown one, who I think is Kento.
He's kind of more of the tough guy archetype, it looks like.
Yeah. And also, he's voiced by, because his voice stood out to me more than anybody else's, and he is voiced by Jason Gray Stanford, who does the voice of Joe Higashi from the Fatal Fury animes.
Huh.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, I know that voice like 100 miles away. So pretty much they show up and they each try to take a run at this guy. And in true martial arts movie form, they don't attack him en masse. They just go one at a time, each getting, bitch slapped and thrown aside.
You'd think they would know the rule of ninjas, you know?
Yeah, you're... If you've got numbers and this guy is 12 feet tall, I think it's okay to kind of dogpile on him. But I mean, that's not the honorable samurai way. So, you know. So yeah, there's no luck against this villain until Mia and Uli show up and say, essentially your chakras or excuse a Naruto term, your spirits are not in line, and you're not essentially using teamwork to fight this guy.
Right, your hearts and minds aren't united. You've got to come together. You've got to learn the power of teamwork.
Yeah, and so I think initially they're like, screw that noise. Like, you know, they kind of all have that sort of that Raphael syndrome from Ninja Turtles, where they're like, I can just handle this on my own. Which, you know, leads to them, you know, getting rocked, essentially. Once they kind of, once Mia draws the bad guy's attention, he, which we'll see as a theme in the show, starts to chain them up and hang them by their necks, essentially, and throwing them into a TV. This TV kind of allows the bad guy to take any damage that's done to himself and apply it to both Uli and Mia inside this TV world.
Which brings up a weird line in this scene as he's, you know, causing damage on himself to hurt Mia and Uli, and he says something about smashing an itch, which you don't really smash itches, last I checked, so.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's trying to keep it from getting infected, because I know if you scratch an itch, it'll get infected, but yeah, smashing, maybe you're kind of just, like, slapping it.
Yeah, maybe slapping a little aloe vera on the wound.
Maybe. Yeah, there you go.
There we go.
Yeah.
Strange, a little bit of strange 90s dubbed anime dialogue.
Yeah, and this episode is full of it, like, whether it be Uli saying smokin', a la The Mask, or... You know, I think Dark Lords, I've failed you, which we'll see later. Yeah, kind of doesn't really come off as the most organic dialogue.
Yeah, I think pretty much the only one we appreciate here is the Siegfried and Roy reference.
Oh, definitely. So, you know, facing this new conundrum of not being able to attack this boss for fear of hurting his hostages... you know, Ryo is kind of forced to regroup, and, you know, I don't think that he kind of does too much thinking in this moment, because even though he knows he can't attack this villain, he decides, like, fuck it, and, just goes ham and does, like, his super move on the guy.
Right, he pulls out, like, almost like a Darth Maul-style version of his blade.
Oh, yeah, they definitely capitalized in that before George Lucas got his filthy paws all over that move.
Which, like, cracks the building in half, too. Like, that was, you know, a little bit of cool excess, I thought there. Like, just stylistically. Like, imagine, you know, watching this kind of thing at 7:30 in the morning before class.
Oh, definitely. And also, you know, he does blow this guy in half and then topples a building... probably killing, like, hundreds of people in the process, but, you know, it's a cartoon, so they don't really focus too much on the, you know, the damages here.
Hopefully they evacuated.
Oh, yeah, or, yeah. We'll see. We'll see. Maybe in the Japanese version they talk about the mass casualties here.
It's a very, very special episode about evacuating on time.
Yeah, just, like, pretty much like a Zack Snyder apology episode. So, I mean, despite this probably should have having... vaporized Uli and Mia, turns out they're fine, and they are now victorious after Ryo has pretty much unlocked this new power of his. So we find that once that is done, that the victory does not last long. They're pretty much spoken to by the big boss of the dynasty, who is named Tulpa.
Yeah, Tulpa, the U.S. name of a much cooler villain name in Japanese, Arago, the Demon Sovereign. Tulpa, the Emperor of the Dynasty.
Yeah, that's way cooler.
But
yeah, Tulpa of the Dynasty, that does not roll off the tongue.
Yeah, Demon Sovereign has class. I like that.
A lot of class.
I mean, I might even follow that guy. I might screw the good guys. This guy's the Demon Sovereign.
Yeah, the Ronin Warriors. Demon Sovereign, come on. Yeah, so do you know if is the dynasty called the dynasty in Japanese, or do you know if it's called something else?
I don't have any info on what the name of the faction was here.
Oh, okay. I'm sure a listener can probably let us know if there was a cooler name for it, or if it was just called the Japanese equivalent of the dynasty.
Yes, please let us know. Please correct us. That's what the internet's for.
I welcome the internet pedantry. Once that is established that Tulpa is now here, he introduces us to his generals, which are pretty much like a dark reflection of the Ronin Warriors themselves for each one.
Yeah, so we get introduced here to Anubis, Kale, Deus, and Sekhmet, I believe. And yeah, like, I would say collectively they're kind of like a dark reflection of the Ronin Warriors. Kind of cool designs on these guys as well. I thought Deus with the weird kind of robot voice as well.
Oh yeah, I love the robot voice.
So cool.
So it was weird that they kind of jump from like Egyptian themes in Anubis and Sekhmet. I don't know if Kale and the other guy kind of correspond to, like, Egyptian mythology either.
Yeah, I no connection that I could find with those names. I actually thought Deus might have been spelt like God in Latin, but it's actually spelled D-A-I-S, apparently. So, yeah. Not,
Deus. Interesting.
Not sure what the theme or the connection was there.
Yeah, I guess the naming conventions were all over the place there.
If there's any if there's anyone who's into mythology that can correct us, please do on our Twitter.
Yeah, so we get introduced to them, and then it's very, you know, foreboding and kind of giving you a taste of things to come, and we are kind of seen, you know, as sort of a challenge that Tulpa sets, saying, like, you Ronin warriors are very weak. You have no chance of defeating us. Here are my four generals. Deuces, pretty much. And, right. I mean, I think he's kind of right. I mean, they struggled pretty hard against just this no-name guy.
Right. Like, if that was their grunt, these guys are going to mess shit up.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think they stand a chance. So I think maybe that's the whole progress of the episode in episode's future. They kind of go on this journey to kind of level up, because I think where they're at right now, they'd pretty much just get washed.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be a journey for them to get on that level.
Yeah. So that's pretty much the episode. So what did you think about it, Jorge?
I had fun. It was very nostalgic for me. It had a lot of the kind of mainstays of the anime that we grew up in. I did watch the occasional episode growing up, but I remember nothing at all. I retained very little, so this was all fresh for me. This was all brand new.
So you never saw any of the episodes when you were, or you saw once or twice, but you were never, like, into the episodes.
Right. Yeah. I never really, it might have been on and I'd have it on in the background, or I'd catch the last 5 minutes before the episode, something else coming on. But, so this was as good as new for me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, especially choosing to watch the dub version for this episode, it really did put me in a time and a place, because just between the very late 80s art style, the really good decision to use the original soundtrack for everything but the intro, I thought that was great. And then just those weird little dialogue and dubbing quirks, it feels like this is very, almost like the quintessential 90s dubbed anime. For me, so it felt good to kind of, like, be in that little nostalgic bubble for 20 minutes.
Yeah, I definitely think you're right. I mean I think it does definitely capture that time and place. I, as a kid, was not familiar with this at all. I remember only being exposed to the action figures for it, but as I couldn't tell you if I've seen a single episode of it. Watching it, though, or seeing it in toys and stuff, it definitely reminded me of, like, Saint Seiya and, like, Knights of the Zodiac, which I was a little bit more familiar with, but not, I would never really watch that either. But, I mean, it's sort of like that same kind of animation style, and you've got your color-coordinating Sentai group, essentially.
Right, it did come across a bit as almost like a blend of, yeah, like, Super Sentai, Saint Seiya, like, all those... kind of even a little bit of shades of, you know, 10 years down the line from this, but even Gundam Wing, you know, with the five pretty boys coming together.
Yeah definitely Gundam Wing. I think you kind of have that, and maybe Gundam Wing is just sort of an answer to, like, Sailor Moon, which I think this was, because we didn't even touch on the transformation sequences, and they have a very Sailor Moon-esque transformation sequence in these big ribbons of Japanese fabric, kind of enveloping Ryo and the other boys to sort of, like, add this armor to themselves.
Right. Yeah, we didn't touch on that earlier, but it was very probably a little subdued compared to something like Sailor Moon, but beautifully animated, like, really cool. Some interesting patterns kind of wrapping around in front of the viewer in the frame there. yeah, definitely a hallmark of that kind of like heroic team genre as well. Now, seeing here actually the director of the first 19 episodes, Masashi Ikeda, directed the first half of Ronin Warriors and the first half of Gundam Wing. So,
oh wow, that's interesting.
There's that connection, I suppose.
I guess if you need to make a series with attractive, talented boys working as a squad, you call that guy.
He's your dude.
And you know, I wonder actually, because I mean, I think Sailor Moon came out in '93. So, I mean, maybe Sailor Moon is influenced by Ronin Warriors, or, I mean, maybe we can find out what the first transformation sequence is in, like, an animation, like an anime. Because, I mean, I know they've been doing it with, like, Masked Rider since the 70s, so maybe it's just sort of a common thing in Japan.
Yeah, I think at some point maybe it's kind of almost like a broad trope, but there is something to, you know, the tokusatsu transformations and the anime transformation sequences are so different.
Right.
Some of that could just be the medium being different, but there's definitely like a through line of like flashy stock footage transformations in these kind of shows. Because, you know, you could make it pretty, you could do it once, and you kill time that you don't have to pay and animate a whole new part for in that episode. So yeah,
that's true. You just reuse it over and over. So what do you think about like the cultural impact of Ronin Warriors, or do you think that there has been one?
It's interesting because I do feel like at the time people were aware of this show, that it was on, or it was their gateway anime or one of their gateway animes, but you know, ultimately I think here in the States it didn't really have as much of a lasting impact. Now I did see that there were a couple of OVAs that were released afterwards, and a new version was released on Blu-ray by Discotech. So, you know, there's obviously some demand for it, but you know, I think in the end maybe it was a victim of being on syndication first or something, but it never. You know, it didn't really take off like a lot of its contemporaries. I mean, Sailor Moon is still getting memed. It's still, you know, it's streaming. Dragon Ball, I mean, what can be said about that hasn't already been said? That's, you know.
Oh yeah, they're still doing Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball. I mean, Super was just a couple years ago that it ended, and I mean, Crystal I think is still going on.
Yeah, so its contemporaries, at least in the U.S., weren't. You know, Ronin Warriors might have just been a typical run-of-the-mill, like, one-season anime in Japan, and maybe that's part of why it didn't take off here. There wasn't more supporting material. They couldn't just go back and, like, ask Sunrise, hey, can you animate 39 more episodes of this show that you were finished with a decade ago?
So, yeah, true. That's probably not the easiest ask.
It's not the move there.
Yeah, and that was something that I kind of caught my eye as well when I was going over the wiki for it. It's like, yeah, it did only last for one season in Japan, and it's like I didn't see if it was due to a cancellation or if it was just the author had pretty much told the story he had intended to tell and didn't think he needed to do anything else.
Yeah, it did feel to me as just one of those typical one-off, one-season anime kind of things from what we've been seeing.
Yes, you're right. I definitely don't think it's in terms of the exposure long term on the American influence of anime. It definitely didn't go as high as, say, Sailor Moon or a Gundam Wing. But I was going over IMDb, and it's got almost 700 reviews, and it holds a solid 7.4 out of 10. So I think that the people that were exposed to it definitely still hold it in very high regard.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean it is a pretty striking show visually, and the, you know, I will say one thing that did, even though I didn't watch it regularly as a child, but the designs always did stick with me. So there's something to be said about that the colorful and like very cool, almost mecha-ish samurai armor designs were very very striking, very memorable.
Yeah, and I think that's always a hallmark of a good anime, is like the superior character design that they do and the thought that goes into character design to make things so contrasting with each other, even though the facial detail is very much the same. I think that the design for armor and clothing is very much something I find very interesting in terms of anime. That was episode one of Aging Otakus. I'm Eric. This is Jorge. You can find us on Twitter at Aging Otakus, where you will find what episodes we'll be going over next, also when new episodes will be going live, as well as random memes that I find funny on Twitter. You can find me also at Chambray_Poppy. If you want to just find me complaining about the state of the world on Twitter, you can also find me there.
And I'm at Jorge, that's J-O-R-G-E, Labrador, like Labrador Retriever, on Twitter. And I'm usually complaining about what depression purchases I just made, because this is 2020. If you've ever stress purchased a comforter, you're my kind of people.
Yeah. And if you bought something out of self-care for the apocalypse that we find ourselves in, let us know on Twitter. And also, if you liked the episode, be sure to rate us. We would definitely enjoy your feedback. And if you have any recommendations for us to go over 80s, 90s, or early 2000s anime, we'd love to hear it. So I hope you guys enjoyed. Signing off, this has been Aging Otakus.